Ego. We all know that. So who is most responsible for the word ego coming into common usage in the English language? Freud. Okay, that's a good guess. Anybody have any other guesses? Jung. That's another good guess. Pardon? Donald Trump. No. He was just illustrating a certain kind of ego dysfunction. Cole, those are all good guesses.
Person in the mirror.
Descartes.
Well, shall we take a vote? Any of you ever heard of James Starchy? Probably not. James Starchy was an English analyst who was one of the first to do decent translations of Freud from his native German in English. And Freud was talking a lot about self and a sense of self and instincts and how they interact and all that. And Starchy came upon, and Freud is using a very common word, self. And Starchy just thought that just didn't sound medical enough. You know, it didn't have the right gravitas. You know, it was all that. And so he got the Latin word, you know, ego, and translated, you know, rather than use self and instinct, he just brought in ego and id, and made it all sound like it was this difficult, clinical, abstract thing. And actually distorted a lot of what Freud was talking about. So this kind of distortion, where that makes something that's really kind of simple and ordinary into something that sounds really difficult and esoteric, is even more common when we move into the spiritual realm. You see it all over the place. Stephen Batchelor, does anybody know Stephen Batchelor? Yeah, he's almost militant about it. Because, you know, he says what happens when you make it esoteric is it gives the, you know, the clergy and the monks and the whoever holds the religious paraphernalia kind of a lot of extra power and status, etc., etc. But a lot of these things, and particularly the spiritual things, are really a lot simpler than they're made out to be. So, how many of you are familiar with the word jhana? Okay, good. Good, good. So what are some of your understandings of what a jhana is? What have you heard? Pardon?
Mind state?
States of absorption. States of absorption.
Concentration.
Yeah, concentration.
Six levels?
Four, eight, depending on how you... Six is fine, that's in between. Anything different? Okay. Well, so I don't have a franchise on the word jhana, and so what it means is really what people use the word think it means. But I will say that when the Buddha used the term jhana, he was not talking about a state of one-pointed absorption. He was talking about something quite different. In fact, sometimes I feel like I'm crawling way down a limb when I say this, so I brought some stuff along. This is the Majjhima Nikaya, which are the middle-length discourses of the Buddha. So there are long discourses, and there's lots of shorter ones, and these are the Goldilocks ones. They're not too long, and they're not too short. So they're long enough where they've got some meat to them, but they're short enough that you can actually get through them. And just a word of warning, how many of you have read any of the suttas? Yeah. You kind of have to be a Buddhist nerd sometimes to get into them because I just have to tell you a story or two. Translation problems. Yeah, everybody thinks you can just translate things from one language to another, but it's really very, very difficult, particularly nuanced stuff. For example, when Pepsi went into China, they took their slogan, come alive with a Pepsi generation, and they just translated it into Chinese and put up on all the billboards until somebody came along and said, you know, in Chinese, what this actually means is Pepsi brings your ancestors back from the dead. And you can see how that would happen. You know, come alive is kind of a metaphor in English, and you just take it a little more literally, and you're bringing your ancestors back from the dead. Or my favorite one was Frank Perdue, you know, Perdue Chicken. And they had the slogan, it takes a tough man to make a tender chicken. And they moved down into Mexico and translated that into Spanish. Anybody want to guess? It came out, it takes an aroused man to make a chicken affectionate. Sexuality has so many nuances. I mean, you can see where it goes astray. So what happens when scholars try to translate this stuff into English is to try to get the nuances right. You know, each word gets expanded into a phrase, and it, you know, and so you may have three words of Pali, which is the language that the earliest talks are recorded in. You know, three or four words of Pali, which are translated into 20 or 25 words of English, and it just gets cumbersome. But anyway, be that as it may, in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses, that carries a pretty good and very usable sampling of what the Buddha really taught about meditation and about living in the world. There's some things that aren't in here, like what monks should do, but none of us are monks or nuns here, so what do we care? There are 152 discourses in here, and I just ran a check the other day, and the word jhana appears in at least once in 76 of these. So we talked about the jhanas a lot. In contrast, breath meditation is talked about in about 10 places. So jhanas are what, 6 times more important? They're just all through the suttas. So in this one, he's talking about the first jhana. So if you have forgotten already, I just wanted to read this because there is this common understanding that jhanas are about one point of absorption. The way some people teach them is that you have to be able to put your mind on a single object and to keep it there unmoving for 3 hours is one of the measures for the first jhana when it's done in this absorption way. The Buddha in his time mastered all these practices because of these deep absorption practices were ones that were most available. But what he found is he went in these deep states, he came out of them, he looked inside, and there was still desire and aversion and delusion in there. So he eventually threw them overboard and taught something quite different. So let me just... I'll read the whole section here and then I'll unpack just a little. Otherwise, he'd be here all night. Here, monks quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. Unwholesome states are states that have a lot of tension in them. Sariputta, in this sutta, somebody asked the Buddha, what happens when you move from ordinary consciousness to enlightenment? And so he described what happened to Sariputta, who was one of his top students and a very, very, very keen intellect. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, Sari entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by discursive thoughts. Right? How many eggs do we need to get? That sort of ordinary thinking. Accompanied by discursive thought, with joy and happiness born of seclusion. And the states of the first jhana, the discursive thought, the joy, the happiness, the unification of mind. And then, this is the second quiz. There are 5 qualities he mentions here. See if anybody recognizes what these are. The contact, feeling, perception, formations, and awareness. The aggregates, the khandhas, that's right. So the khandhas are raw sensation. Khandhas are each khandha is a collection of a type of experience. Raw sensation, feeling, perception, which is labeling things, ideas, beliefs, storylines, mental stuff, and awareness. There is nothing that we can experience that doesn't fit into one of those five. Okay. That's enough. The point is that in the first jhana, there's everything going on in there that happens in everyday awareness. And along with that, he does mention there's joy and happiness. And so we'll get to that in a minute. But the point is that the way that Buddha used the term is not talking about this highly esoteric. People who train in those concentrative states, some of them will go on retreats for 6 months and not be able to get into the first jhana by those definitions. He was talking about something very different. So tonight I would like to talk about the jhanas. I've had a lot of training in the monk that I trained with this got discouraged with his own progress and his students' progress, and on the advice of a fellow monk threw away all he had learned from all the commentaries and all that stuff and went into retreat, went into a cave in Burma. And I guess it was in Thailand at that time, with a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya, and just combed through it to see what the Buddha actually said about meditation, and then try to put that into practice. And what comes out of that is an incredibly powerful practice that is simple, highly integrated. And that it works with the jhanas, because the Buddha talked about them all the time. And what the Buddha meant by jhana is just a stage of meditative knowledge. Okay? A stage of meditative understanding. Meditative there means it's an understanding you have that is based on direct experience. Somebody asks, is it raining outside? Well, you go read the paper, you could think about the time of year, you could sort of figure out what it is and come to some kind of conclusion, or you could look out the window. You look out the window and all the stuff you've thought about just doesn't make any difference anymore. It's a direct experience. So he's talking about a stage of direct experience and how they unfold from everyday awareness into nibbana. And we can talk about what nibbana is later if you want. I just want to say a couple things about them in general, and then I'll walk you through them. And Selin said I was a Unitarian minister until I retired, and I used to tell my congregation, my job is to speak, your job is to listen, and if you finish your job before I finish mine, just raise your hand because I'd rather have a discussion anyway. So feel free to interrupt me. The first thing to understand, there are eight jhanas or four jhanas with four substages called bases. I just call them eight jhanas. It's simpler. But what they just represent, if you think about, I do a lot of hiking up in the High Sierras. If you think about hiking through the High Sierras, you're following along a path, and sometimes you may be in a forest, sometimes you may be out in a meadow, sometimes you may be out, along a ridge, all kinds of different places. But the transition from one to the other is actually quite gradual. And so the jhanas are just arbitrary markers. It's not like you warp or make a quantum leap from one to the other. It's just an unfolding. The second thing I would say about them is to get clear about the quality of awareness that we're trying to cultivate here. When I was about 9 years old, I went into my very first cave, a real cave. Park ranger, I was on vacation, a park ranger took me and my family and, I don't know, maybe a dozen and a half other people, about a half a mile into this mountain. And when we got to the innermost chamber, we came to this place and there were just some lights lighting up the floor, and we could see some benches and handrails and stuff around. And the park ranger said, sit down or take hold of one of the rails, because she was going to turn the lights off. And she did. And I sat there waiting for my eyes to adjust to the dark. But as you know, they just won't, because there's no light to adjust to. You can't see anything. And so then she turned on a flashlight. And it was one of these big 4D cell flashlights, sent out this really powerful beam straight up. And you look up and you could see this spot about this big around on the ceiling of this chamber. A few cracks, some water up there. And she shined it behind me. Look around at the wall. There's a little piece of a rock formation. Shined it down at the far end. I was very impressed with the flashlight, but in terms of an experience of the cave, it was very unsatisfying, because all there was were these little fragments of data. Really didn't have any sense of the cavern as a whole. So she turned the flashlight off, and she lit a candle. It was one candle. Literally, one candle power. And I remember, as a 9-year-old, it was the most amazing experience, because the candle just sent out this soft glow in all directions at once. And the whole cavern was lit up, not brightly, but with this soft glow, where I could see the floor and the river going through, and all the people and stalactites and stalagmites and subchambers and the whole thing. So there are some kinds of meditation that try to develop the mind like a flashlight, like a laser beam, that focuses in on one object until it just gets it to stay there. I don't want to offend anybody, but you know what the byproduct of those practices are? Makes us a little stupid. So think about it. What do you do when you hypnotize somebody? You tell them to put all their attention on one object, maybe a shiny spoon, and blot out everything else. And when they get deeply, deeply focused, you know, you say, you're a chicken. Right? If there were the slightest amount of wisdom or intelligence engaged, you know, that's a stupid question. But when your mind gets really locked in there, Utejaniya, he's a Burmese monk, amazing guy. A student was talking about sitting there in retreat, and she said she kept on bending over like this without realizing it. You know, and she'd be there for a long time, and her back, and she suddenly realized her back was sore. And he said to her, well, you're getting a little too concentrated. Because when your mind gets really concentrated, you don't know what's going on anywhere else. You don't recognize that. Well, what the Buddha was interested in were not these states, but what actually liberates, what actually brings freedom, is seeing how all this stuff works together. Seeing what causes and conditions give rise to other causes and conditions. We begin to see it's all really impersonal. But you have to be able to see how things interact together. So the kind of meditation that he taught was one that really cultivates this wide 360-degree kind of awareness. And, you know, those absorption states can be valuable for some things, and some people find them very helpful. But for some people they can be helpful in the beginning, unless we get our awareness where we're paying attention to our awareness, awareness of awareness, we just don't go very far. So the second point is, a type of awareness that's being cultivated here is one that's actually quite broad and quite receptive. And it can be very, very stable, but it's open and sensitive. And we can talk about that more later. So So when I'm teaching this meditation, what I usually use for, or encourage people to use, as an object of meditation to start off with, is actually what are called the Brahma-viharas, so uplifted states, kindness, compassion, joy, gratitude, peacefulness, qualities of mind that are qualities of mind as opposed to an object out there. A little sidebar, I was thinking of Utejaniya. In order to develop this wide open awareness, it takes a mind that's relaxed as opposed to focused. So Utejaniya says once, so what does going to the toilet, falling asleep, and meditation have in common? They work better if you don't try too hard, right? And so there's a lot about this practice and developing this whole open awareness that requires a lot of softening. So, sitting in meditation and sending out kindness, peacefulness, ease to yourself, to other people. I won't go into the details of how the practice works, but that's basically that. And when the mind goes off, you're using the 6 R's. So when the mind goes off, as I said earlier, there's always a little bit of extra tension in there, so you're constantly releasing the tension. When I started this practice, I could, I might have been meditating for 25 or 30 years then, and I could sit for an hour and a half, an hour 45 minutes without moving in a retreat, fairly reliably. And when I started this practice, within about a week, I was sitting like 3 hours. And the reason was just because I was letting go of that tension all the time. So it actually becomes a lot easier. So you're sitting in meditation, sending out kindness, compassion to others, to yourself. And then at some point, there's this little spike of joy. It seems to arise quite spontaneously, but you're sitting there and there's just this kind of sense of uplift. For some people it can be gentle, some people can be just absolutely blown, can be a huge powerful thing. But there's this little bit of joy that just arises spontaneously, and then it begins to dissipate into a broader kind of joy. It's called happiness, sukha. And then that spreads out a little more into equanimity, and the mind is usually trained to pay attention to things, and so as the energy gets quieter, it gets bored and it wanders off and it's gone. So there's this little spike that goes joy, and then it softens happiness into equanimity. And at first that little spike may last 2 seconds or longer. So is this familiar to anybody? Most of you have meditated, I'm sure. You've had some time, you're sitting, and this little joy comes up. And that's the first jhana. Not terribly esoteric. Then what happens is you keep practicing, and as you practice more, 6 R-ing things and releasing and just going along, what happens is that little spike gets longer. The joy lasts longer, and it subsides less quickly. The happiness feels stronger, and the equanimity lasts longer. And so you're sitting there, and there's a place that thinks, "Oh, this is working," you know, and you get a little confidence in it. And at the same time, since you've been releasing that extra energy there, the mind starts to quiet down. And at first it feels like, sometimes it feels like the mind just sort of drops. So the background noise is like cut in half. So it's not absolutely quiet, there's still thoughts and stuff floating around in the background. This is the second jhana. in the first jhana, when people are starting off, one of the ways you can tell is that I invite them to use simple phrases. May I be peaceful, may you be peaceful, may you be happy. Some of you are familiar with these. And at some point they'll come in for an interview, a yogi will come in, and they'll say, you know, those phrases, they feel clunky. You know, what's happened is that the metta, the kindness, the peacefulness, get so strong that the phrases feel coarse in comparison. So the invitation then is just to drop the phrases. So you just send it out. And the Buddha called this noble silence. So a lot of you may be noble silence, as on retreats you don't talk to anybody. What the Buddha was actually talking about with noble silence was when this mind quiets. So then what happens? Are you with me? So then what happens is you keep practicing and the joy doesn't come up so much anymore. You sit down and you just go right into the equanimity. And these, I teach in the Thai forest style, so that you have individual interviews with each student every day. And some of those interviews can be a little comical because the yogi comes in and you can see there's this this deep equanimity. And the suttas, they say there that other people notice a peaceful abiding. So they come in a very calm. So I ask, what's going on? Nothing. But the joy is gone. So, well, okay, so you got any problems? No. I stepped on a nail, but I think it'll come out. But the joy is gone. No. So what happens, a lot of people think when that joy starts to disappear, is they've actually lost the practice. Because the joy can be so wonderful. But the joy that comes up actually has a lot of energy in it. And so as that dissipates and they go into this, and because it has a lot of energy, it can't last very long because it expends itself. But you find people just in this equanimity. So I have a poem here about equanimity. My favorite poem of all time. This is the third jhana. Now we're ready to look at something pretty special. It is a duck riding the ocean 100 feet beyond the surf. No, it isn't a gull. A gull always has a raucous touch about him. This is some sort of duck. And he cuddles in the swells. He isn't cold, and he is thinking things over. There's a big heaving in the Atlantic, and he is part of it. He looks a bit like a mandarin or the Lord Buddha meditating under the bow tree, but he has hardly enough above the eyes to be a philosopher. He has poise, however, which is what philosophers must have. He can rest while the Atlantic heaves because he rests in the Atlantic. Probably he doesn't know how large the ocean is, and neither do you. But he realizes it. And what does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. He reposes in the immediate as if it were infinity, which it is. That is religion, and the duck has it. He has made himself part of the boundless by easing himself into it just where it touches him. I like the little duck. He doesn't know much, but he has religion. So that's the third jhana. It's called equanimity. What it really is a kind of stability. You are not absorbed on one object, And if you're absorbed in one object and something comes loud enough to break your concentration, it can be annoying. When in this equanimity, there can be all kinds of disturbances come in, and they just sort of pass through you like an energy wave. They don't throw you off balance. That's the third jhana. The fourth jhana is a little bit more of the same. It goes deeper, but what happens is the body gets so relaxed and it's so much at peace that it stops sending as many signals. I was doing a retreat with John Travis up in the high Sierras, about 8,000 feet in this house, and there was a road that came through a pass. It was about a half a mile up the mountain from there. And the road went past the house, and so these big trucks would come up, and they would be headed down there, and they would downshift. It was like an 18-wheeler on flatulence. You know, and when the first day I was there, I just found this incredibly annoying. And by the third or fourth day, I realized, oh, those trucks are gone. That's great. But when I thought about it, I actually paid attention. No, they were all still there. But it just, I had enough equanimity that it was almost like they faded off into the background. You know, if I paid attention to them, I could see them. But without paying attention to them, it was not a problem. When I was training in Thailand, nobody has pet dogs or cats there. They're too expensive. And so nobody likes the dogs and stuff that are around, except, you know, in the Wats, you know, in their version of monasteries. They're fed and stuff. So there are all these dogs that are through there all the time. And so sometimes they were trying to kill each other on the door of my kuti and my meditation hut. And again, at first it was really, really annoying, but as it got quieter, they just become part of the sounds of life that are off in the background that you can see and know, but they don't throw you off balance. And in the fourth jhana, what happens is it gets so relaxed that sometimes it feels like you'll be sitting there and it's like, my arm is missing. You know, and you wiggle it and it's there. You ever had that experience? See, I used to, when I was, couldn't have been older than 5 or 6, I used to lie in the bathtub. Still, when I was small enough, I could stretch it the whole length. I had my little rubber toys and the bubble bath, and I would just relax. My ears would be below the waterline. And I try to relax so much that, you know, my leg would disappear and our hand would disappear. Anybody ever do that? Yeah, that's fun. Well, that's actually a sign of the fourth jhana. So again, we're not talking about stuff that's real esoteric, but it is deeply relaxed, and the equanimity comes not by quieting the mind down, but by releasing the tension, so it just gets more and more and more relaxed. It's called arupa upekkha. Upekkha means equanimity, rupa means body, a means without. And at that point, the Buddha would consider you an advanced meditator. It's right there in the suttas. So what happens next, as you keep practicing, is it becomes very, very spacious. As the mind, heart get deeply relaxed, there's a sense of expansiveness. I remember sitting, so when I was living in Massachusetts, I had an office up in the attic of our house, and I used to go up there and meditate at night. And I can remember closing my eyes in the dark, and it would be completely black, just like in that cave. And it was like I was staring at a blank wall with my eyes closed. And then at one point, suddenly, nothing changed, but rather than a blank wall, it was like I was looking at an infinite space. Some of you have felt that. One of the reasons I talk about these things is that, this is a sidebar, but that in the West, there are many of us that have these very curious minds, And sometimes they just go right out there. And we experience things, and then it collapses. And then think, ah. Sokni Rinpoche was meeting with a bunch of senior teachers at Spirit Rock. And Sokni Rinpoche has taught in this country and in Canada for maybe 25 years, and he also teaches in Tibet. And so they ask him, what's the difference between your Tibetan and your Western students? And he says, oh, the Western students get it much more quickly. And you think, what? And he said, oh, yeah, you know, there's these minds that go out there and they just get it. And then they go home and they think, well, did I really experience that? And I'm not sure whether, you know, because that inquiry goes into doubt very quickly, and what's on TV tonight anyway? And so it collapses. And so a lot of people in the West can go out there, but it doesn't stabilize. As opposed, they said, his Tibetan students, they move very slowly, but once they got someplace, they never lost it. So I think there's something about teaching people who grow up in Western cultures that how this unfolds for us may be a little different than it is in some of the Eastern cultures that, after all, are more devotional. And so I'm just trying to figure out ways to kind of utilize these experiences, because when you're out there, there's something that you can do with that little bit of spaciousness that actually moves your practice along. So, good.
So, are we talking about your 40 years of meditation here, or the 40 minutes, or what is the time frame of these different states unfolding?
I helped lead a retreat with my teacher last spring. There were 25 people there. There was one woman who came in who was working in the second or third jhana. This was like the second or third day. And she got up to leave, and she stopped at the door. And she said, you know, there's this funny thing that happened. And she went on and gave a absolutely crystal clear description of the eighth jhana. On this particular retreat, I hesitate to say this, but well, I'll just tell you, and I'll pay for it later. But we had seven people who got stream entry. So sometimes I think there's a ripeness, you know, in the West right now. There's a lot of stuff coming along. You know, me moving through it took a long time. I mean, I worked at this for years, but I'll see some of my students will zip through. And there's a curious thing, because there was a couple of people that got stream entry, and within a month they'd stopped meditating and lost it all. And so I'm trying to look at this whole phenomena, you know. So she got into some states, and you could see it. You know, she had really, and I quizzed her. I could see it. She'd really gotten it. And then she lost it completely. And I think that she can probably get it back quickly, because once you touch into stuff, it opens up. So it's causes and conditions. It's people's karma, it's ripeness, it's all kinds of things. All that I know is that it's a lot easier, and it does take work. You know, the opening line of my book is, waking up is not easy, but without ease it's impossible. You know, and so some of it, particularly in the West, where, you know, we're kind of uptight going to sleep, there's something about learning how to balance that, and once you find the balance, the mind just opens out. Just opens out. So I don't have a real good answer to that. I can just give you a few pieces of data about what I see happening to people. Any other questions? Stream entry. I'm sorry. It's first stage of enlightenment. I tell you what, I will zip through the other jhanas, and then I can describe it, okay? Because we're going to run out of time, and I want to leave a lot of time for questions and answers, but let me do this. So there's a spaciousness, and I imagine there's a lot of you have felt some spaciousness, right? And what happens next is it gets so spacious, and this is hard to describe, but it's like you're so relaxed that your awareness starts to break up a little bit. And it's so relaxed that it doesn't seem disturbing. And I'm going to rush through that. This will be unsatisfying. I'm sorry. Another way that people experience the sixth jhana is that there'll be moments of very profound peace, just really deep quiet, and then they slide out of it. And what you do at that point is you put your awareness into that deep peace or into those little breaks. And that takes you into, it's the seventh jhana, it's called the realm of nothingness, which I think is a mistranslation. I think it's no things. I had a yogi I was talking to a couple of weeks ago. I was on retreat and he had just gotten out of his interview and he said, well, Bhante says that I'm in the seventh jhana, but he probably doesn't know what he's talking about. And so I asked him, I said, so the stuff that comes into your mind, is there anything that has reference to anything outside the mind? What happens in the seventh jhana is there's lots of stuff going on and you see pushes and pulls and different textures, but you're not thinking about whether you fed the cat. You know, all those have faded away. I'm probably going too fast here. I'll keep going and then we can back up because I want to get to your question. So what you do in the seventh jhana, and I would say in a retreat in past years when we didn't get so much stream entry, in past years that with 25 people by the end of the retreat, most of them would be in the seventh jhana after about 10 days. It goes very quickly. Things change a lot from the seventh jhana. What happens at that point is the instructions change slightly as you go along, and at that point, your object of meditation is actually equanimity that you were sending out in all directions. And what happens is that in order to form a memory, a bird flies by, in order to remember it, it takes just a little bit of tension to kind of put that into storage. We do it so automatically we don't notice it. Does that make sense? And to actually perceive something, I mean, you could look at something, the stimulus come in, and if you don't have just a little bit of tension there, you won't even see it. What happens is the mind gets so relaxed that you are no longer forming memories or perceptions. So the eighth jhana is called neither perception or non-perception. In my book, I describe it as it feels like looking through a pair of high-powered binoculars into a fog bank. You know, all the mechanism is still, but there's just nothing registering. And as it goes deeper, the subjective experience of it is actually blacking out. So if you look back over the past minute and you have absolutely no memory of it, it seems like a blank spot. Right? So I had this, a yogi came in, it was on the last day of this retreat, and he was a very sweet man, really bright, pretty unassuming. And he said, Bhante was gone, so I was doing the retreats, the interviews by myself. And he said to me, Doug, you know, I get right down there where there's just nothing going on. Mind is so peaceful and it's quiet and then I fall asleep. And I said to him, so when you wake up, what's it like? Are you groggy? Oh, no, my mind is clear, bright. And I said, you know, you're going into cessation. which is where all that stuff just shuts down, you know, for just for a moment, and it comes back. So there's, I call it winking out. Winking out. I was trying to find some way that covers a whole bunch of phenomena that just, because that's what it feels like. You just sort of wink out for a moment. And you won't see it coming. But afterwards you realize, oh, you know, where was I? And at that point the mind is actually quite luminous. And I could see it in this guy. I mean, he just glowed. I mean, he was a little shy, but it was like just, you know, beneath that shyness, it was just luminous. And so what happens is that in the eighth jhana, you go into these places where a yogi might come in and say, is it possible to be awake and asleep at the same time? And that's sometimes a sign, because you get on this place where you're kind of stuff going on, but you're not sure. And I think there's this other phenomena that happens that, you know, when we go to sleep, one of the parts of the brain that turns off is the time and space orientation. It's why when you're dreaming, you can be all over the place. And in the dream, it seems perfectly normal. And then you wake up and you remember the dream and say, that's pretty weird. And I think, you know, in the eighth jhana, as that goes offline, and so a lot of that time and space orientation gets a little, little fuzzy. So what happens is that when somebody winks out, in instructions that are in the suttas, is that when you come out of that, you look back into it and see if there's any tension, and if there was, you six-R it. So you're deeply training the mind-heart to just relax any tension that comes up, even before you perceive it. And so you go in, and there's a little bit of tension, and that's called cessation, nirodha. And then you go in, and there's nothing. And that's called nibbana. So I say nibbana is actually nothing. But it's a profound nothing. And what happens to people when they actually go fully into and they come back is first thing that happens is your identification with the personal self is severed. It's just gone. But it's sort of like unplugging your computer from the wall, the whole thing, not your laptop, but the old desktop. The whole thing goes, and you plug it back in, and it boots back up. Well, all the software comes back up. So you come out of that, and you've all got all this neural wiring about ways you think about yourself, et cetera, et cetera. All that comes back online. But you don't believe it quite. You know, Gurdjieff, this Russian mystic, he said once, once you have a taste of the truth, you can't fool yourself quite as sincerely. You know, so you can still fool yourself. All that stuff comes back, but there's a little place that doesn't quite buy it completely. And that's called stream entry. And then it unfolds from there, but that's another. The stream entry is actually going out and then coming back. And there's some things we ask. You know, so for example, the instructions are when you come back from that, we just go meditate. There's still more to be done. And most people can't for a couple of days. There is so much energy and there's a profound feeling of relief. And the text, they say, for example, you can't break a precept any longer, but I think that's a distortion. What happens is if you go to lie to somebody, for example, you can feel the impact of that back on you so quickly that I think of it as you can put your hand on the table and hit it with a hammer only if you think it's not going to hurt. But if you know it's going to hurt, it's like the motivation is gone. So it becomes harder and harder to break precepts, not because you can't, but because you just feel the blowback from it so immediately. And there is some of the cultural conditioning that you just don't quite buy. But it's subtle. You know, it's subtle. And I'm afraid I may be off into Nananunu land for some people, so Let me open it up for some more questions and see if we can get grounded here, including skepticism. Yeah. Hi.
But I get the impression that you're not real enamored with Vipassana inside meditation and the end meta of the time. And you know, I'm a little sensitive about that.
Yes.
That's what I was trained in.
Me too. Me too.
So, did I hear you wrong?
Probably not, but I can clarify that somewhat. Yeah. Is that so what I learned at Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Mass., you know, I was back there, and then Spirit Rock, the standard Vipassana, is one-pointed concentration. And then when the mind got steady enough, as you go into choiceless awareness. And what you're trying to do is cultivate a quality of mind in which insight is more likely to arise. Okay? And this practice, the way I teach it, has all the elements that you'd be familiar with Vipassana and insight. They're just put together a little bit differently. There is a way that's... So if you look at the suttas, the way the breath awareness is taught, particularly if you just look at the fourth section of the Satipatthana Sutta, and Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is it's difficult. He says, breathing in, the monk tranquilizes the formations. And I don't know about you, but I read that and I think, tranquilize, tranquilizers, formation, rock, you know, we're going to put, you know, medication on stuff. You know, I have no idea what it's talking about. But what it's actually talking about is tranquilize comes from the word tranquility. And formations means anything that's been put together, which includes our thoughts, our bodies, stuff that's put together. So what it's actually saying is bring tranquility to the formations are a more sort of folksy translation, an accurate one, is to relax. So breathing in, you relax. Breathing out, you relax. On both the in-breath and the out-breath. Those are the instructions. They're in the Anapanasati Sutta, all of them. But most people actually don't do that. So if you actually go back to what the Buddha said and do that, with that that deep relaxation in there, this whole thing will open up just the same way. I shift over to using metta and kindness for two reasons. One is that most of us Westerners grow up with a lot of self-hatred that we don't even recognize. And for us to get into a more balanced state, to actually start with loving kindness, puts us actually in a more balanced place to start off with. So that's one reason. And then for others is that if somebody has practiced a lot being aware of the breath without doing the relaxation, it's a hard habit to break. And so it's just easier to do that. But there are some people who do this using that. So if you take, what's actually, in the suttas describing this and apply that, including that relaxation step, it'll come to right to the same place. So I have a tremendous amount of gratitude actually to Jack and Joseph and Sharon Salzberg and, just a lot of other teachers that I've had that teach out of that tradition. And actually it was John Travis who recognized I was going into jhanas and put me in touch with this monk. And then I came back and I went on a retreat with John, and John said, well, don't do anything I say, just do his instructions. And my practice just took off. And because what was going on was I was subtly fighting my own thoughts. And I realized that, if a thought comes up and I recognize, release, relax, there would be this sort of burst of well-being as the tension in that relaxed. and it felt like I was almost on psychedelics, where I got to the point. I was just waiting for a thought to come up, because all I have to do is release it, and I get this little blast. So it is. It's all grounded in the same practice, but it's a softer, easier way of going at it. So is there?
I've heard other people talk about jealousy.
Yes.
It seems to me that there's kind of like a hook to the whole genre kind of discussion. And the hook is that people fall in love with the process and rather than what their original goal was. For instance, when you were talking to the genre, I was thinking, have I been in the mix? Have I been in the set, comparing and just being in love with the process? Instead of just saying, okay, well, what was the original intent for me to meditate in?
Yeah, and I would say those intentions are really important to start with. And when I was in the eighth, working in the seventh and trying to get into the eighth, I finally got it, and I said to Bhante, I said, I can't get in the eighth, can I? And he smiled and he said, that's right, you can't get into the eighth if there's any sense of self that's left. And so it actually becomes more and more process. And you end up, well, as Larry Rosenberg, who is the guiding teacher at Cambridge Insight, said, most people are trying to get from A to Z, and he said, we're just trying to get from A to A. And so what the process is actually, well, it's those two aspirations I said in the beginning. It's what it really is. Seeking to observe the mind, heart, without preference. And so there's preferences in the beginning, but as it goes deeper, even subtle wanting to get someplace is enough to block the whole thing. So you end up, and for me, I got to that really just out of desperation or frustration, because I had tried everything else. I would say I did it wrong every way I could possibly figure out how to do, and there's nothing left but kind of give up and say, okay, I'm never going to get there, so I might as well just see what's going on, and that's when it would open up. So it's this process of observing the mind, heart, without preference, and really looking just for clarity and acceptance of what's there. And then what happens, when you're releasing the tension all the time, is you begin to realize that there's this deep equanimity that is closer to our true nature than anything else. And this deep, clear awareness that is closer to our essence than anything else. But they do nothing, absolutely nothing, to draw our attention. And so as you relax more and more, what happens is this, it's almost a kind of a luminous quality, comes up of its own. And, I want to get there, and it's gone. Okay, I give up. It's back. It's comical from a certain perspective. So, we've got 1 minute. Yes?
How does one practice the jhanas outside of the context of a multi-day, 10, 20, 30, 90-day retreat? And what can... I mean, how does a practitioner who doesn't have the surplus time or the dedication or commitment to get themselves into scenario where they can reach these deep states of awareness,
yes,
how is it practical for people who meditate for 35 to 30 minutes to an hour a day?
Well, see, the assumption is that it's very difficult to get to those. And that's one of the assumptions that I'm challenging. So I teach classes, in order to come into class, I require people sit at least 30 minutes a day, and that's usually enough to get up to, the third jhana anyway. And by then, there's enough relaxation where there's actually a draw, to want to sit longer. And what we do in the classes, because at each of these jhanas, when a yogi, when a student is going through these, they may not necessarily know what jhana they're in. It's not important that they know. It's just that I know, because there's certain ways you tweak the practice to take advantage of that. And so in class, one of the things we do is people report where they are, and I'll, you know, and we tweak it. And I get people, you know, up into the seventh, without doing retreats. It's easier on retreat, you know, to do that. And then the other thing we do is we do, you know, day long, so you can, like, you know, settle in and get a little bit of momentum. The Burmese jhanas, the absorption ones, are associated with these long, you know, 3 month retreats, etc. These actually don't take that. And there are ways to get enough benefit from it. Just in a daily practice. I mean, you do have to sit, but it's not as difficult as you might think. So I think I can hang around. I'd love to talk about this stuff, but some of you have to work for a living and all kinds of inconveniences. So let's pause for just a moment to share some merit, send out some metta. So it's, you know, when I come back from a retreat or good meditation, my family is very grateful I was doing that. So when we do this practice, or any kind of practice that actually goes deep, the people around us benefit from it, you know, even if we're not trying to do it for them. And you can feel it, you know, when there's somebody that has a lot of, you know, a lot of calm, it leaks out and we absorb it. So we get benefit from other people's practices. So we live in this network of relationships. Some of it is very, very subtle. But we're never doing this for ourselves alone, no matter what our minds tell us. So knowing that, let us just sit here for a moment. And just imagine or feel that field of relationships that we live within, and sending out through that vast network the wish, may all beings be happy. May all beings live out their life in peace and have the means to do so. May all beings know joy. May all beings have ease and well-being as they go through their day. May all beings have sweet dreams.